Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Ladies and gentlemen, Buff, the postmodern idiot savant.
Is postmodernism really to blame for post-truth?
Yeah, postmodernism made it respectable to deny sensible ideas, like truth and fact.
No, it didn't. It just said when you think about those ideas, you also have to think about power.
I'm a modern man for the millennium, digital and smoke-free, a diversified multicultural postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect.
Do we really think an obscure academic movement from the 1950s is responsible for the woeful state of politics today?
Did postmodernism simply predict cynicism about facts, or did it actually promote it?
Can truth make a comeback?
Our guest is Tom Dzengatita, author of Postmodern Theory and Progressive Politics.
Is postmodernism really to blame for post-truth?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again, now more than ever.
So here's what to do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. Did postmodern attacks on truth do lasting damage to the fabric of society?
Did they help to usher in a post-truth era, the era of anti-vaxxers, alternative facts, and climate denial?
Or can postmodern theory help us find a way out of our current political mess?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, a program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're asking, is postmodernism to blame for the post-truth era?
Oh, Josh, I don't know. Look, I don't like the post-truth era any more than you do. And I get it that we got people like Kellyanne Conway talking about alternative facts and that sort of nonsense. But really, seriously, what's that got to do with postmodern theory?
Well, I'm with Daniel Dennett on this. You know, he blamed the postmodernists for what he called the intellectual fad that made it respectable to be cynical about truth and facts.
Wait a minute. Come on, seriously? Are you saying that all these post-truthers like the aforementioned Kellyanne Conway or Sarah Huckabee Sanders or Rudy Giuliani, you think they've been at least like sitting around and like reading their diary? I wouldn't give them that much credit.
Well, I don't know about those folks, but take Mike Chernovich, the alt-right conspiracy theorist. You know, he said, I kid you not, I read postmodernist theory in college. If everything's a narrative, then we need alternatives to the dominant narrative. I don't seem like a guy who reads Lacan, do I?
Well, that's a little wild, I guess, but surely he's the exception. Come on, most of these post-truthers can't read anything.
Maybe, but look, the pernicious effects of postmodernism went way beyond the people who actually bothered to read it.
Oh, come on. How's that supposed to have worked? What, they did mind control somehow?
No. The postmodern theory infected the culture at large, Ken. And once it did that, it silenced the gatekeepers. It made experts reluctant to push back against nonsense. I mean, look, if everyone has his or her own truth, then who are the so-called experts to tell someone they're wrong?
Well, those so-called experts, come on. Did you ever notice who those experts all happen to be? Heterosexual white males. I mean, if you're going to give postmodernism credit for silencing, then that's a good thing because that means it liberated us from the hegemony of such people.
Yeah, but by insisting there's no truth.
Well, by insisting that there's no single truth, Josh, but there are many truths. I mean, come on, postmodernism showed that white male heterosexual worldview is just one view among others. It's not any privileged sort of thing, so it struck a blow for equality. That's a good thing.
That is a good thing, but look, think about, there are different ways of doing that. If you think about people like Du Bois of Beauvoir, you know, those folks, they criticize that kind of narrowness and bigotry, but in the name of truth. I mean, if you want to attack lies, just say there are lies. You don't have to say there's no such thing as truth.
Well, but isn't that what they were getting at? Isn't that what the postmodernists were really saying? I mean, think of Jean Baudrillard. He wasn't celebrating the fact that everyone now has their own truth. He was actually lamenting it, John.
Whoa. Slow down, Ken. Look, a minute ago you were saying there's no objective truth. Now you're saying there is. You're doing exactly what postmodernists do. You're contradicting yourself.
Well, Josh, come on. Seriously. Haven't you heard? A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
Oh, well, you must have a really big mind if it's going to contain all those Pomo contradictions.
Okay, touche. But in all seriousness, Baudrillard, I think he's a good example. He took himself to be warning us about the post-truth world he saw us busily falling into, and he thought of himself as giving us tools to understand it. So if you think of it that way, postmodernism didn't cause the post-truth problem. It's going to help us solve the post-truth problem.
Well, maybe for Baudrillard, but what about Derrida or Rorty? I mean, Rorty came right out and said, no scientific description is an accurate representation of the way the world is. A climate deniers would be delighted to hear that.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are delighted to hear that. But I don't think that's at all what postmodernists intended. They weren't giving succor to climate deniers. What they wanted to do was to challenge traditional power structures, and they want to bring about a more inclusive politics. Surely that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. But why did they need to ditch truth in order to get there, Ken? I mean, yeah, think about Rorty saying the very idea of a fact of the matter is one we'd be better off without. I mean, would we really be better off without a fact of the matter about climate change? No way. You know, you can't just duck the consequences of your views just because you didn't intend them.
Well, okay, look, you know, I'm going to concede one thing. There's a lot to talk about here. And maybe our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, can help. We sent her to investigate what today's philosophers from around the world think about the relationship between post-truth and postmodernism. She files this report.
My name is Marjorie Perloff. I'm a retired chaired professor at Stanford University.
My name is Justin E.H. Smith. I am a professor in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Paris, Denis Diderot.
I'm Alexis Papazoglou. I used to teach philosophy at Royal Holloway, the University of London, and before that, the University of Cambridge.
My name is Ken Houston, and I lecture in international relations at Webster University's Thailand campus.
When the term postmodernism originally was used, it was used almost synonymously with the avant-garde. Postmodernism was everything that was new and cool and different.
I do take postmodernism to be an irrationalist tendency to the extent that, well, how should we define it? Should we define it with, say, Lyotard and say that postmodernism is the view that there are no longer any grand overarching narratives? That sounds like a pretty good way to start.
It became taken over by the French theorists like Derrida, Foucault, and so forth. And then it started to get a negative meaning of not believing in anything, no truth, anything goes.
It was, I think, the morning of the US presidential election when I was leading a graduate seminar on Nietzsche's critique of truth back in London. And there seemed to be a kind of eerie echo in relation to what was going on at the time and what Nietzsche was suggesting, namely that there was no kind of objective truth and that the concept of truth that most philosophers had relied on until then was a kind of philosophical hoax.
But the idea that it is responsible for the conditions today, I think no, on the contrary. I think what is responsible for the conditions today are the social media, which nobody had quite dreamt of in the heyday of postmodernism.
Blaming postmodernism for today's manifest problems around post-truth and the breakdown of shared understandings actually inhibits our ability to comprehend and examine the real reasons why we have these problems.
What we're calling the post-truth moment doesn't mean that people care less about truth than before. It only means that there is a particularly new, powerful technology for the spreading of lies.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks, Holly, for that report. With many truths and no one truth articulated in a postmodern fashion, I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're asking, is the post-truth era the fault of postmodern theory?
We're joined now by Thomas DeZengotita, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Thomas.
Thank you.
So, Thomas, you're deeply interested in postmodernism and post-truth politics and how the two relate or don't relate. But how did you first get interested in this subject matter?
I first got interested in what I later realized was the essence of the post-truth age when I was in acting school, a method acting school. Method means you don't act, you react, you live in the moment. A bunch of us actors were in the dance studio. Someone came in and said the president, meaning President Kennedy, had been shot. Somebody else whispered, it's an improvisation. And we all immediately fell into the business of being real in that moment and went on for 20 minutes, people sobbing and screaming. And finally someone else came in and had a radio, and we suddenly found out that this wasn't an improv, that it was real. And in that moment, the difference between reality and representation became so stark as I watched it being eroded and erased.
Wow.
And that, to me, is the essence of postmodernism.
That's a transformative moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes.
And, you know, you've obviously been a lover of postmodernism ever since, but I think you know that it has a bad name.
I don't know where you get that idea.
Well,
but
just not the case.
It's not like, you could talk about that, because, you know, I'm sure you know that in some circles, like this one right here, it has not such a good name. So mm-hmm. What do you think, you know, why did it get that name, and do you think it's deserved?
No. I think if by postmodernism we mean the academic brouhahas about the canon and the French theory and all of that, one of your roving reporter guests said it best. I mean, that's just got nothing, not nothing. There's an influence, but practically nothing to do with the rise of post-truth politics as you understand it. The guest who said it had to do with the new technologies and the social technology, that was correct.
So wait a minute. So postmodernism in the academic circles. So let's talk about that for a second. I mean, on my side of the campus, I'm a philosopher. I'm an analytically trained philosopher, although I've fallen away from the high church in certain ways. On my campus, there were these bitter cultural wars. They were mostly contained within the academy. I don't know who won those cultural wars, but they were bitter. Do you think, do you think that was just nothing? Was it just sound and fury signifying nothing?
No, like everything else that happens on the level of ideology and sort of conscious articulation, it reflected what was really going on in the world. And if you go back and parse out the details of those arguments, you'll discover that the underlying theme has to do with whether or not you can clearly separate representation from reality.
But that sounds
like
the kind of thing that those academics were talking about.
Very much so. But they were talking about it strictly in their academic terms. Meanwhile, the difference between representation and reality in life, in society itself, is disappearing. That's what mattered. The academic discourse was just reflecting.
But hang on. You told us an anecdote a moment ago about the death of Kennedy. And I mean, surely everyone could tell the difference. I mean, maybe, of course, if an actor is a good actor, they give the impression of someone
good
who's
point.
Mourning. But it's not
good
like
point.
You don't know the difference. And that's what your story
good,
was about. Your story
point.
Was all about
Yeah, but
the difference.
Dig it. Listen up. Listen
tell
up.
Us more.
30 years later, I'm watching the mourners for Princess Diana on the streets of London. And I'm reminded of that actor, the actor's moment. And as I'm watching those mourners, I'm realizing their grief is real, but they are also performing it.
They're performing it. I'm not sure. Connect that up to your. I get that their grief is real. They're not just representing grief. They're performing their grief. But
and
I'm not
call
quite
that
sure.
Representing it.
Yeah.
By performing it, I mean representing it.
Right. Okay. But. Why is that a distinctively postmodern thought? That's what I don't get. Really briefly.
Because.
And then we need to go to a break.
Because they're at some level conscious of themselves doing so, and they build and construct a performative life more or less like building a work of art.
I think I get it. We'll come back to it. I think I get what you're saying, and I think there's a deep point there. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about postmodernism and post-truth with Thomas DeZengotita, author of Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It.
Did postmodernism diagnose the ills of our post-truth world, or did it help to create them? And why were so many famous thinkers so excited about the idea of a post-truth society? Haven't recent events proven them profoundly mistaken?
Postmodernism, utopia, dystopia, or myopia? Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. My truth, your truth, his truth, her truth. Will the real truth, if there is such a thing, please stand up? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and today we're thinking about post-truth and postmodernism. Our guest is Thomas DeZenghetita, author of Postmodern Theory and Progressive Politics Toward a New Humanism.
So, Thomas, let's dig in. I mean, we were getting toward this at the end of the first segment there. But let's dig in a little deeper into what postmodernism actually says and is. So, look, if you had to sum it up, I'm going to give you the task of summing it up. How would you crystallize the central idea of postmodernism?
I think I'd take Richard Rorty's moderate, modest articulation of it. And it basically says what Hegel meant when he said, philosophy is an age grasped in thought. I'm now talking about what I'm answering your question in terms of academic postmodernism.
Okay.
So that, broadly speaking, I think that the truths that we tell each other are shaped, fashioned by historical, cultural circumstances. That doesn't mean that they don't have some objective truth value, by the way. That's just not the way to think about it.
That's not what Rorty said.
Well, let him think.
Right. Oh, no. No. On the contrary. The kind of objectivity he was talking about was the kind that John Dewey articulated when he made exactly the same point when he introduced Americans to pragmatism. It isn't that there isn't any objectivity. It's just the danger of it's there's no absolute objectivity. Okay?
Well, right.
The enemy is the absolute, not the truth.
So Rorty thought of himself, as I gather, and he was my colleague for a while, but not in my same department. But he was in comp lit rather than philosophy. But Rorty thought of himself, first he thought of himself as an old-style analytic philosopher. He was what's called an eliminative materialist. That's a long thing I'm not going to explain. Then he thought of himself as a pragmatist. And then yes. Literary theorists got all gaga over him because they thought
that
of him
as
a postmodernist. So are you telling me that postmodernism really is... people fail to talk to each other a lot in this era.
Oh, boy.
Are you really telling me that postmodernism is really deeply allied to American-style pragmatism?
Very, very much so.
I mean, I like...
In substance, in content.
If it really were that, I think I would have an easier time with it. But, you know, I have this issue a lot when I talk to defenders of postmodernism that they want to claim certain things on behalf of these thinkers. But Rorty said... you know, straight out, objects are not more objectively described in any vocabulary than any other. And I could list you a series of quotes from him.
But he was trying to be a pragmatist in saying that, because William James says stuff like that. There's the thing that matters is not what's out there, as it were, but what I can't remember the exact quote from James, but it's what we make
right.
of what presses in on us. The world just rushes in. What the world does, it just puts energy on our sensory apparatus, and what we make of that inrush of energy is entirely up to us. Right?
Right,
the world doesn't dictate that.
But there's two kinds of pragmatism, right? I mean, there's the kind that says, let's just figure out, and Rorty sometimes talked about this way, let's just figure out the best solution to our problems and set aside ideology.
That's the Rorty I talked.
And that I'm totally in favor of. But the other kind of pragmatism is the pragmatic theory of truth. Right? So Rorty thought in order to solve the world's problems, we have to get rid of the notion of truth. And he said the very notion of a fact of the matter is one we'd be better off
without.
Well,
that's deeply pragmatic. But Tom, what do you think?
And that's a direct quote.
But there's a larger context, I'm sure. And my guess is that if you dig into it, what you'll find him objecting to is the idea of some absolute objectivity or absolute truth.
Given his roots through this... his mm-hmm. route to postmodernism. Again, Rorty's hard church analytic. He wrote he edited the essay was the Bible the linguistic turn. Right?
You should read his introduction to the second edition.
Yeah. So he started out analytic philosophy, absolutely, the linguistic turn, the analysis of meaning, all that stuff.
That's what made him so annoying to the analytic people. He betrayed them.
Right. He was in.
And when he became president of the American Philosophical Association, the place went bananas. It was practically a riot.
But what he thought. As opposed to what people thought of him, is that philosophy in the mirror of nature and all that stuff was just the natural development of where he started out. It was just the natural outcome. So when he's talking about the absence of objective fact, he's being a Jamesian pragmatist. That's really what he's doing. And the pragmatic theory of truth. But that's not really how most people think of postmodernism. They don't think of it. They don't come at it through the root of a Rorty who started out. They come at it through this French root, right?
I'll grant you that. And that's why I stressed when I was responding before the idea of the substance. Okay. Now, when it comes to the style, all right, that was so annoying to so many traditional academics, the French style, you know, the obscurity, the intentional game playing with words and all of that stuff. Rorty never did that.
Oh, hang on. Let me tell you something about Rorty. On the one hand, there's the things the postmodernists said, right? So they said a lot of things. Like Gianni Vattimo has an essay, "Farewell to Truth." They said a lot of things about the impossibility of truth, the non-existence of truth. But it's how they behaved that really proved they didn't care about the truth. So Derrida, for example, insisting high and low on his rights as an author, proved he was never serious. I had a conversation with Rorty once where I asked him, why are you attributing these views to Nietzsche when he doesn't really have them? And Rorty said, it makes him a more interesting philosopher.
Well,
and that's a verbatim quote.
Okay. I don't want to get into the weeds of this.
I bet you had to be there.
They clearly didn't care.
Okay, but I want to back up a bit. Because one of the things, because I don't want to get in the weeds of interpreting, we've been talking about how postmodernism got its bad reputation and whether it's deserved, right? And I think that's a complicated thing. I think it got its bad reputation because there were a lot of bad writers and bad thinkers who said some things that were true and some things that were false, and they mixed them all up. That's what I think. But I don't take that to be gospel. I'm just one guy. But the thing that the postmodernists were aiming at, and I think this is in all of them, was a liberatory movement. It was supposed to liberate us from the hegemony of this old order, which deserved being eliminated, liberated from. So tell me, how is that supposed to work?
That's the part of me that does see something redemptive and promising about postmodernism.
So tell me how that's supposed to work.
Well, I think if everyone would just settle down and be as afraid of autocratic populism on the rise in the world, all over the world, thanks to the post-truth moment in many ways, and, you know, rational people on all sides of this debate would hang their grudges up in the closet and get serious about what is worth saving in the postmodern agenda, namely the liberation of gays, women, minorities of all sorts. That whole thing was good. That was right. And if the canon had to suffer a few decades of abuse in order to make that happen, that's a small price to pay for progress given the bloody history of our species.
We'll come back to that, because that's an intriguing and provocative thought. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about postmodernism and post-truth politics, whether postmodernism caused or can cure post-truth politics. And we've got Lee, all the way from Boston's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lee. You must be listening online. Thanks for doing so.
Yeah, thank you very much. Enjoy your program. So I'm a philosopher. I'm at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University, and I've got a book called Post-Truth, where I've got a chapter claiming that postmodernism is one of the roots of post-truth. And here's my evidence. At least part of post-truth is science denial, climate change denial, anti-vax, things like that. But before those, which are relatively modern, came evolution denial. And in my chapter, I talk about Robert Pennock, another philosopher, who's done all the scholarship to show that the one of the founders of the intelligent design theory, Philip Johnson, was a postmodernist. Philip Johnson, there are extensive quotations where he says things like, I mean, he says verbatim, he's a postmodernist and a deconstructionist, but that he's aiming at a slightly different target. Well, the target he's aiming at is evolution, and what he means to do is to deconstruct evolution by showing that, you know, well, you can't just say that evolution is true and that creationism is not. You have to really teach both, which is what post-truth is all about. It's the idea of exploding, the idea that there's one truth and claiming that there are many truths, and then that way you can, you know, shoehorn all sorts of false things into the classroom
so, Lee,
or in public consciousness.
Lee, thanks for the provocative and intelligent and insightful comment. I'm going to push that to Thomas and see how he responds, but thanks a lot for the call, Lee. What do you think, Tom?
I think, I don't know this particular gentleman or quote, but I know for a fact that a lot of people on the right, both the religious right and the political right, took great pleasure in pretending that they were being influenced by postmodernism and advancing things like anti-evolution and different discourses.
But I thought
so
there was no difference between pretense and reality.
Oh, Josh,
I didn't say pretense. I said representation. I didn't say pretense.
He's
and
being
thinking
pretty.
That performances are pretenses just shows you've never been to.
No, wait.
To
okay,
school.
You guys, come on, calm down. I'm going to be the neutral referee here. But I'll put the point slightly differently. Okay, suppose it's a mistake of the right that you talked about to take postmodernism as
there you go.
Suppose it is a mistake. It's a mistake that postmodernism in its excesses invites and does nothing to guard itself against.
I agree. And the 80% of me that thinks that postmodernists, again, I'm talking about the academy now, made huge, unnecessary, excessive gestures and just horse manure all over the place, and it's giant errors that they made, tactically, strategically, stylistically, all so much of it unnecessary, a real waste.
So you
but
seem like a
the
guy.
Cause,
who,
the cause was just.
You seem
the
like a guy who just. Really wants to save postmodernism from itself, right?
Is that's that very. That I'm going to remember that. That's beautiful. That's exactly what I'm trying to do.
And I have to say, you know, I think, you know, by stripping away some of these excesses, I feel like you're making the strongest case for it. But I want to ask you a question, even about the strongest case, because I'm very tempted by the idea that it's a way of dismantling this kind of hierarchy and this sort of, you know, a kind of predominance over the intellectual space of, you know, cisgender heterosexual white males.
Exactly.
And that seems like a thing that's worth dismantling. So the question I have there is, did it have to be done in this way? Because it seems like there are two routes to a kind of democratization of the intellectual space.
Great question.
One of which is essentially a kind of populism where you say, look, you don't really need any formal training. Whatever you come in with, whatever idea you currently have, that's equally valid. It's as valid as anybody else's. So it's a kind of, as it were, lowering the bar. And then the other route is essentially raising up of the general population, a universal education. Let's really make a serious good faith effort to get everyone involved in higher education, to diversify the faculty, to do all those things that would actually, that's, you know, keeping the bar high, but moving everyone as much as possible in the direction of those heights. Now, I worry that postmodernism is basically the first solution. It's saying, well, look, you know, ultimately anything goes, and your view is as good as mine, and the experts, you know, expertise is just a kind of cover for hegemony. And I'm not entirely comfortable with that.
I worry about that too. And that is the messy, again, that's just, I don't need to repeat myself. The way they went about this was a disaster.
Yeah. So we got another caller on the line. Sam from Alameda. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sam. What's your comment or question?
Yeah. Hi. I wonder if you guys can link this up with the Zen Buddhist kind of notion of the name is not the thing. And what I was taught a long time ago about extreme relativism, where everything depends on everything else.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I can, but maybe Tom Can you link that up with Zen Buddhism?
This is, Nietzsche's rightly been cited as sort of the fountainhead of all this. His earliest essay, Truth Lies in the Non-Moral Sense, he was a hell of a critic of Buddhism, but he would have bought completely the name is not the thing. And the whole problem for him was that language was simply inadequate. Yeah. One of you guys said about energy coming at us, our sensors, and our language isn't equipped. That's Dewey's basic thing. Our language is simply, and now here I'd part company with, I think the exception to that has proven itself so far to be mathematics.
Well, I'm
and
not
I'd
sure.
I'd be almost in Daniel Dennett's camp when it comes to mathematics.
Well, I wouldn't be. I think mathematics, pure mathematics, is a realm of fictional objects. But I think this is a deep problem.
Okay.
I think it is a very deep problem that I don't know that any philosophy has the answer to. Kant had an answer. We make the world, right? I mean, the inward rush from the outward world. We have no idea what the outward world is doing on itself. We construct the world in accordance with these categories. And that's where this whole mess gets going with the content inside.
I couldn't agree with you more. And when I say the excessive ways in which postmodernism went about its business, driven by this political fury at the injustice of the hierarchy that you've referred to, and they're young. They're kids. It's the 60s. I mean, come on.
I agree. And I totally agree with your diagnosis. I guess the question I have is, look, if ultimately the good part of postmodernism reduces back to the kinds of things that Kant was saying, which are really fascinating and important, then why did we need postmodernism?
Well, because Kant was only the start of it. Because Kant thought the categories and the organizing stuff were fixed once and for all and universal and all that stuff. And then when you start to have a Hegelian historicizing of this, that the categories of reason come and go.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly right. That's why I went to the Hegel thing about age, grasp, and thought. But yeah, exactly. I don't need to add to that.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Well, so look, we're agreed that there is some important and deep impulses behind postmodernism, married with a lot of confusion and rhetoric and stuff. We're
Absolutely.
Agreed about that. But what I want to know and what we'll get to in the next segment is how we go forward right from this moment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about postmodernism and post-truth with Thomas de Zangotita, author of Mediated, How the Media Shapes Your World and the Way You Live in It.
Could postmodern theory help us imagine a better way of doing politics? Could it actually offer solutions rather than just exacerbating problems?
The possibility of progressive politics of POMO when Philosophy Talk continues. Are postmodern theories really to blame for those who pursue policies of untruth? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Thomas de Zangotita, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. We're thinking about post-truth and postmodernism.
So, Thomas, I think you don't like our current political landscape any more than I do or Josh does. I get the clear impression. And we're all devoted to finding ways to reshape and ameliorate that landscape. The thing I'm not sure of is that postmodern thought, even in its best form, has a way of helping us. Make your best case that postmodern thought can somehow help us reconfigure this political landscape.
Among the many excessive blunders that postmodern theorists made was turning their back on the phenomenology in philosophy. I'm talking about Husserl, Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty. Part of their attack on modernity and on the modern subject was an excessive dismantling of phenomenology. Phenomenology as a way of doing philosophy still holds open the possibility of dealing with difference with respect and at the same time discovering what common essences or whatever you want to, this common truths, real truths about the human condition. And that the possibilities of phenomenology have yet to be explored, especially in relation to anthropology. That's what I'm working on now.
So tell me more about that. I mean, so phenomenology, that's not my bailiwick, but I take it, here's a crude statement of phenomenology. First person lived experience is deeply revelatory of truths that can't be captured in any other, from any other perspective. I mean, physics is not going to replace first-person lived experience as a source of truth.
Never.
I mean, it may supplement it, right? But it's not going to replace it. Okay, but how does starting and respecting the autonomy and integrity of first-person lived experience, how is that going to help us ameliorate the political landscape?
Because it is possible to discover by starting with first-person lived experience constituents of first-person lived experience that you know, and I can't justify this in this context right now, that we don't have time, but it makes it possible for you to know that certain aspects of your first-person lived experience are universal. If I could have the time just to go to an anthropology example and why I think anthropology is so important with this, I'm talking about reviving the project of philosophical anthropology. There is no culture known to the anthropological archive that I know of where if equally ranked people encounter each other in a public place and one of the people greets the other person and the other person doesn't return the greeting, that is universally an insult. That's an ethical universal.
It's so interesting.
And it's the beginning of a new politics.
This is one of the things I love about your work, that you're trying to rescue some of these beliefs that seem to be being put under pressure by the postmodernists. But I take it that what they would say back to that, and I'm just being devil's advocate here, what they would say back to that is these universals you're talking about are just pseudo universals, and they're just a kind of a mask for power, right?
That's why I need to go to the anthropology, because that's just empirical. If what I'm saying is empirical, just straightforward, like to a kid in the kitchen, your mouth is covered with jam, did you eat the cookies? That kind of truth, that level of truth. There's no argument.
I'm not sure. Okay, again, I'm not a postmodernist, I don't think. I don't even try to play one on the radio. But here's the thing that the postmodernism does or purports to do. It doesn't undermine the lived experience in the way, say, that reductionistic science does, right? It doesn't undermine the subject in that way, but it does undermine the subject in another way. It does challenge the subject because it says, look, you're always historically situated, you're always shaped by these forces that you don't know, and when you claim that your subjectivity gives rise to universals that you can parade as universals, that's just a lie. You're just self-deceived. You don't understand the true sources of yourself.
Again, forgive me, that's just wrong. Deep reading of, let's say, Heidegger on equipment, the nature of equipmentality and tools. And I mean, it's like 25 pages in Being and Time. All you have to do is look at it. Well, different cultures have different tools. All cultures have some tools.
Right.
Why do they have two? Different cultures have way different ways of eating. But they all have ways of eating.
I understand. I'm not
against
universals.
There's no culture in which there's not a way of eating.
I'm not against universals. I'm not against cultural universals. Indeed, I'm a deep believer in something that some postmodernists don't believe in. I believe that the evolution designed the human mind, and just as there are linguistic universals, there are cultural universals. Wait a minute.
Okay.
But here's the thing. What I can't figure out is how you're supposed to rescue such an insight within postmodernism. That's what I don't get. Without going like the Kantian route, that the mind has a fixed architecture and all that sort of stuff, but they reject that. They go this Hegelian route.
This is the point at which you say, okay, you guys, your moment came and your moment went, just as Rorty always said about everybody's moment. You performed an enormously important task with the political, the political agenda that you had for justice for everybody, real justice for everybody. But, time to go away, time to rethink what you're really up to. You just pay attention to the faces of people in Black Lives Matter and talking about what. Just look at these kids' faces and tell me that they're not asking to be respected as a human being.
I get you.
Gay marriage became marriage equality because it was implicitly understood that what we were talking about is people's humanity.
I think I've been framing you a wrong way. You invited, when I said it, you said yes. You said
no, no, I didn't. I said you. That's not. I go no, back over the transcript. I didn't say it. When you called me a fan of postmodernism,
that was
specifically
Josh. That was Josh.
Sorry,
but I said, I said, and you accepted, that you're the person who's trying to save postmodernism from yourself, from itself. And
no,
you said
from
that's
itself,
no.
Yes.
You said that's right. That's right. I'm gonna. But you're okay. Actually trying to say to postmodernism, you're done. You're done. Your day is over.
What's the difference? It's overcome. You know, it's self-overcoming is the path to fulfillment.
Well, here's the difference. Look, here's the difference. Okay. You're a fun guy, Tom.
That was a pretty good one.
Don't go all contradictory on it. You're a fun guy. You're fun to talk to, but don't go all contradictory on me. Here's the difference. Here's the difference. I'm not trying to save the Republican Party from, well, in some moons I want to save the Republican Party from itself and make it be a better Republican Party, a true market-oriented party, and all that sort of stuff. I think, okay, you guys, we need two parties, not just one. You get to be the market party, but you don't get to be the xenophobic, racist, anti-gay. You don't get to be that party. You get to be a modern capitalist party in a two-party democracy. Okay, but if you're going to be that hodgepodge of anti-modernism, anti-racist, xenophobic, if you're going to be that Republican Party, I'd rather you just go away and be replaced by a new party. So what is it? Are you like, okay, postmodern party, shape up and jettison all the nonsense, or are you like, postmodern party, go away and let us replace you by another party?
Given those options, I would say postmodernism, jettison all the nonsense, get serious, and realize that you were wrong about the, just because there's no absolute truth doesn't mean there's no truth. Mm-hmm. And just because there's the modern subject isn't the iconic representative of all human subjectivity doesn't mean that there aren't unique human subjects that are the essential ethical and political roots.
See, you sound more like an existentialist than a postmodernist to me, right?
Well, one of you rightly said that the ways in which postmodernism kind of confused itself are manifold, and one of them is they made themselves sound a whole lot more different from existentialists than they actually were.
Right. Yeah, and I wonder if this is another place for phenomenology to come back in. You made a very nice argument earlier about phenomenology as a route to the discovery of universals. Would you also say that maybe it's a possible route to respect, right? If we give a kind of serious and loving attention to the first person perspective, then you know I should honor and take seriously, be interested in
that's why I use the example of the greeting to start
with.
And that's also why I call your attention to the faces of the people who've been victims of systematic injustice. Recognition, it all begins with recognition.
So
I could be you, you could be me. That's
right, so that begins. Okay, that I like a lot. But sometimes people get hooked up, all tangled up over the goodness and badness of identity politics. And identity politics, we've done episodes on identity politics, let's say in our time, is something of a mess. But I want to replace the talk of identity politics with, and some people talk this way, talk of a politics of recognition, where there is the other. I recognize the other. I recognize something of myself in the other. And okay, other, let's build a world together, right?
I'm with you, man.
I'm with you too. And that doesn't seem to me a particularly postmodern idea. It doesn't seem to me an anti-modern idea. But it does seem to me. Here's the thing I think about the old Lockean kind of democratic politics and all that sort of stuff. It was mostly insincere, but at its core, there was also, in Rousseau and Locke and the social contract there was also, fundamentally, I recognize in you a person who has sovereignty over him or herself, and let's build a world together. Okay, they weren't always consistent, because they saw the black other and they said, oh, I don't recognize you, right?
Fanon, in Wretched of the Earth, he says, Western European modernity has articulated all the ideas we need for a just world. They just don't practice it.
Right. So, politics and the reform of politics. Should we just hold ourselves to these modernist ideas of recognition, or do we have to go beyond modernist ideas? What do you think? That'll be our last thought. Okay. Do we need to go beyond?
I think it would be possible to call the idea of recognition a modernist one, justly. But the struggle on a practical political level for actual recognition.
Oh, that's fraud.
Recognition.
Oh, that's completely fraud.
That was the achievement of the postmodern moment. The hypocrisy of modernist humanism had to be exposed because there was not genuine recognition of the other in it. There was in principle recognition, but that's not real.
Oh, well, I know. That's because people are hypocrites. But you know what?
You know, I'm all about ethics. If you want to know my bottom line, is politics better go back to ethics.
Yeah. Tom, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a lively conversation. And you know what? I think there was even some truth in it.
I think so, too. I believe in a small t truth.
Okay, our guest has been Thomas DeZangatita, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Postmodern Theory and Progressive Politics, Toward a New Humanism. So, Josh, are you more well or ill-disposed toward postmodernism?
It's complicated. I mean, I really like Tom's super stripped-down POMO, but as you say, it starts to sound like something that isn't necessarily POMO anymore in existentialism. And I still worry that, you know, we've let our guard down. It's Kurt Anderson's point, you know, the spread of postmodernist theory into the wider culture has made the gatekeepers let their guard down, and that's not been a good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community, and please do by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now, a man who cares at least as much about speed as he does about truth, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the hermeneutics of suspicion, refers to the trains of thought that rose in the modern age. Freudianism, Marxism, Darwinism, then we started putting monkey wrenches in those monkey wrenches, and we are where we are now, trying to turn ignorance into bliss and not remembering how. When I was in college, it was all about the literature of exhaustion. Fiction was experimental, because it was easier to write in lowercase stream of consciousness than to map out a 1,000-page novel, unless you're writing an airport thriller. Come to think of it, there actually was an airport thriller called Airport, and there's your postmodern literature of exhaustion right there, like a murderer whose name is Killer. Ironic. Postmodern is kind of like Dada, only self-conscious about it, with a college degree prominently displayed. It's not a rejection of ideas so much as taking them to their logical extreme. Culturally, we get movies like Star Wars, which began as an homage to pot-boiler movie serials, straight-faced, almost a parody, but has since, in its cultural impact, become equivalent to Greek mythology. How did that happen? We don't know. Our certainties are our doubts. We know we don't know about chemtrails, vaccinations, who killed Kennedy, who swung the votes for Trump, if identity is fluid or not. Those and other worries keep the prescription drugs flowing, but nobody really cares if we went to the moon, really, unless you're an astronaut. We're probably not going again, unless we can build a mid-sized town up there, like the Green Zone in Iraq or Des Moines. I realized just the other day that I'd forgotten what Marxism is. I mean, its manifestations. Mao was kind of snippy about Stalin, but peasants versus factory workers aside, were there really that many differences between the two? Again, when I was in college, many literary critics were described as Marxist, and I think, are you kidding me? Soon enough, though, this fiddly Marxism was supplanted by radical feminism and by what is now called theory, postmodernism. All this just seems like Way Street Paradise Lost, for example, without falling asleep. Christianity, too, got shaken up in the late 19th century. A guy named Schofield put out a Bible with annotations, which became the template for what is now called postmillennial dispensationalism. See, there are two versions of the Second Coming. The Catholic version, so to speak, as Jesus meeting us in the middle of the air as we are swept up bodily to heaven, the end. The modern version as Christians being lifted out of their shoes, no Jesus in sight. As sinners mill around, confused, the Antichrist shows up, disguised as a charismatic Bosnian industrialist, ushering in a false prosperity and then a global war ending in Israel with many converted Jews and millennial saints getting snatched off to heaven as the damned go down to hell with the industrialist long since revealed as indwelling Satan. Good stuff. Everybody loves the rapture, even non-believers. It brings postmodern joy. But not to be critical, what is the point of that period between the rapture and the final battle? Christians are taken up twice? Catholics are right, seems to me. Cut to the defeat of Satan and then do the rapture, like driving home after the fireworks. Those are the end-time choices, though. Just those two. No use waiting for another spin on it. We're done with all that. We'll have too negative an effect on Israel foreign policy. We will not have a Khrushchevist version of communism, no Billy Grahamist theology. The end of history was not eschatological at all. Just another damn epic. History 2.0. All they have left of communism is political correctness and the Antifa, who for some reason are more feared by the media than the FA. What's that all about? I guess fascism will never go out of style. Other than that, it is a postmodern world. All opinions, no dogma. Can't cure cancer, but we can make a razor that shaves closer. Dialectical materialism, forget about it. History, whatever else it might be, is not science. Realizing that made me grateful for the postmodern surge of unbelieving or disbelieving or whatever was brought to the table, if in fact it is a table, Mao gave us the concept of third world countries. Postmodernism gave us the concept of first world problems. See the difference? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I think the effect is pretty clear. It allows people to take a very radical stance, you know, more radical than thou, but to be completely dissociated from anything that's happening for many reasons. One reason is nobody can understand a word they're saying.